Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's election day tomorrow in Afghanistan. A good day of voting, and America and its NATO partners will declare a milestone. A bad day, and the Taliban will brag. Odds are, both will happen. British diplomat, soldier, scholar Rory Stewart knows Afghanistan yard by yard. He walked across it. Now he says it's time to rethink the strategy being championed in Washington. This hour On Point, a reality check and rethink on Afghanistan. You can join the conversation. How do you see the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan? If this is Obama's war now, is he fighting it the right way? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll hear in a moment from Rory Stewart in London, but joining me first from Kabul, Afghanistan, is Laura King, correspondent there for the Los Angeles Times. We last spoke with her in late July. Laura, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, just to the basic question, does it look as though Afghans will and will be able to come out to the polls for the vote?
It does look as if people will come out, but there's no denying that there's a very jittery air because of the recent wave of violence, both in Kabul and out in the countryside.
We're not asking you to predict anything here, but just sitting or being in Kabul and around the country, is there a presumption about Hamid Karzai, the sitting president, that he's being seriously challenged or that he's most likely to be reelected? What's this conventional wisdom, at least?
Well, what is clear is that Karzai, who was considered a hands-down favorite when the campaign began 2 months ago, does face a serious challenge from three of his principal rivals. Between them, in order to deprive him of a victory on Election Day tomorrow, all they have to do is make sure that he doesn't get 51% of the vote. And his three rivals do seem as if they might be in a position to do that.
In terms of Afghan government direction and policy, do any of the three rivals promise a significant shift or change in direction if elected to replace Karzai?
Well, one of the ones who has gotten the most attention from the West is Ashraf Ghani, the former finance minister. But of the three main contenders, he's polling the lowest in the surveys that have been conducted, only about 6%. But many Western diplomats hope that he might agree to take some kind of an important post in a new Karzai-led government, if there is one, perhaps as the chief executive, because his financial stewardship during his time that he was the finance minister was much admired and very much needed at this juncture.
You know, in Iraq, we saw Americans and others setting sort of hurdles that they said, if we get X percent of turnout, it will show that we're making progress here. Do you know, are people predicting what kind of percent turnout there may be? And how do the various players here, plan to judge whether this is, quote unquote, successful or not?
There has been a real reluctance among election observers, diplomats, to set any kind of a magic number, a benchmark. It's recognized that the turnout is going to be much lower in certain parts of the country where fighting has been the most severe, in the south and the east. So in those areas, it's really not expected that as many people as last time in 2004 will be able to come to the polls.
And in terms of the war, the conflict, as we understand it, do people have the sense that this election might change it, change the chemistry of it, or the parameters of the conflict? Or do Afghans see the vote in that way?
Well, there is always such an air of fatalism here surrounding large public events like an election, and you don't really see so many people voicing an idealistic view of what's likely to take place. I mean, no one thinks that regardless of who's elected, that there's going to be some kind of an overnight change here in Afghanistan where conditions are generally seen as having worsened steadily over the last few years.
Laura King is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She joined us from Kabul, Afghanistan. Laura, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks.
Here's President Barack Obama on Monday this week at the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention in Phoenix, Arizona, saying the United States has no choice but to push ahead in Afghanistan.
There will be more difficult days ahead. The insurgency in Afghanistan didn't just happen overnight, and we won't defeat it overnight. This will not be quick nor easy. But we must never forget, this is not a war of choice. This is a war of necessity.
This is not a war of choice. This is a war of necessity. We're taking a little reality check and maybe a rethink on Afghanistan this hour. Joining me now from London is Rory Stewart, diplomat, soldier, scholar, and an influential global voice on Afghanistan policy and culture. He famously walked across Afghanistan, or most of it, in 2002 and wrote about it in his best-selling book, The Places in Between. In 2003, he was part of the British war effort in Iraq, a deputy governor in the South. He's now director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and widely expected to run as a conservative candidate for the British Parliament. In 2005, he moved to Afghanistan and created the Turquoise Mountain Foundation, dedicated to revitalizing the country. Rory Stewart in London, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
Americans listened, American veterans in particular, to President Obama this week before our Veterans of Foreign War Convention. What do you make of the president's kind of formulation there of our war effort, our overall effort in Afghanistan? Difficult days ahead, insurgency, won't happen overnight, won't be easy. It's not a war of choice, war of necessity. What are you thinking when you hear that, Rory Stewart?
I think I'm most worried by war of choice, war of necessity, because I think that's not a very useful distinction. When you begin to say things are a war of necessity, it begins to look like you're writing a blank check, that you're saying we have an open-ended commitment, that failure is not an option. And it stops you being realistic about how important Afghanistan really is in terms of the U.S. strategic priorities. I think there are probably a dozen other countries in the world which are equally, if not more important than Afghanistan. And it also somehow implies that there's no limit to the amount of resources and troops you might put into the situation. So I think that is worrying.
You're recently back from Afghanistan. You just had recently a long piece in the London Review of Books headlined The Irresistible Illusion. What's the irresistible illusion you're referring to?
I think the irresistible illusion is that there are a whole series of things: state building, fighting the Taliban, stabilizing Pakistan, fighting terrorism, which are revolving around in the air. And different politicians in the US and Europe use these justifications again and again. And they overlap. People are confused between them. It's very, very difficult to get any clear sense of anyone about what the real objective is here. So President Obama, for example, begins generally in his speeches by saying this is really about terrorism, it's about 9/11 and al-Qaeda. But quite soon you find that his discussion of what to do expands endlessly till it begins to talk about a legitimate, effective state, defeating the Taliban, stabilizing the region. The illusion is that all these things are somehow connected, that we can't make any choices here. It's all or nothing. Unless we create a legitimate, effective state, we're not going to be able to protect U.S. national security. I think that's very dangerous, because I think that really will, unless that logic is broken, mean that we're going to end up committing far more troops, far more resources, losing far more lives than the situation justifies.
The U.S. Already has more than 60,000 troops in Afghanistan. Of course, NATO partners have troops there as well. The U.K., the U.S. is headed up to maybe 68,000 in coming months. You write that you see a fundamental contradiction in the counterinsurgency effort and the nation-building effort, though those are often presented by American administration officials as one. What's the contradiction?
At the heart of this is an idea that the most dangerous thing in the world are failed states, and therefore the idea from the generals and from the politicians is that what we need to do in Afghanistan is create a stable, functioning state. So they're investing in the police force, in the military, in the judicial system. They're trying to bring economic development. All these are good things for Afghans. They're good things to work for. But if you were going to be brutally honest about this, Afghanistan is a very poor, traumatized, developing country. You could put 20 years of investment into Afghanistan in development terms, and you would produce a country that would probably look a bit like Pakistan. And that wouldn't really help U.S. national security very much. There's a good reason to do it, but the reason is to help Afghans. It's not really got much to do with U.S. national security. In fact, if you look at Pakistan, Osama bin Laden is almost certainly there, not in Afghanistan. Pakistan has a nuclear bomb, has the opportunity of destabilizing India. So there's no direct relationship between investing and stabilizing a state and necessarily making the United States any safer.
You're a British veteran, I believe. Politically, you're a conservative, a Tory, maybe even a candidate for the British Parliament as a conservative. Are you an anti-war guy? Are you a pacifist? Where do you begin? What's your opening perspective here, Rory?
I'm certainly not a pacifist. I'm somebody who believes strongly that our militaries are amongst the most impressive, most valuable parts of our countries. The U.S. military is an astonishing organization, and I really believe it should not be squandered. One of the most destructive things in the long term for the morale of an organization, for its credibility, is to be put into situations where there is no clear rationale. And soldiers will unfortunately, of course, pick up that the politicians are confused, that there may not be a clear definition of what they're doing. And ultimately that means that we're wasting some of our finest resources in unjustified situations. So what I would be saying is, of course, the U.S. has responsibilities to Afghanistan, but it has responsibilities all over the world. And it would be better to husband our resources, to treasure this military, and to use it in a responsible but very limited fashion to try to address the threats that will emerge in the next 20 or 30 years. And they're going to go a long way beyond Afghanistan. I mean, I've said just recently that, of course, Pakistan is 20 times more important than Afghanistan, which raises the question of why we're putting 20 times more investment into Afghanistan.
Though President Obama has drawn a line here. He said, we must fight and win here. I mean, that's the basic message. Rory Stewart, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On the eve of Afghan elections, we are talking today with British diplomat, soldier, scholar Rory Stewart. He's walked across most of Afghanistan, did it in 2002, spent a lot of time there since, was also in Iraq as a deputy governor in the south. He says it's time for a rethink here. Rory Stewart joins us from London. And Rory Stewart, if you don't mind, I'd like to listen to just a little bit more of the President Obama here this week in Phoenix, talking to veterans of foreign wars about the American effort and efforts in advance of the election.
In recent weeks, we've seen our troops do their part. They've gone into new areas, taking the fight to the Taliban in villages and towns where residents have been terrorized for years. They're adapting new tactics, knowing that it's not enough to kill extremists and terrorists. We also need to protect the Afghan people and improve their daily lives. And today, our troops are helping to secure polling places for this week's election so that Afghans can choose the future that they want.
President Obama in Phoenix, Arizona, this week. Rory Stewart's in London. Again, Rory Stewart, when you hear that, and this is a message the Americans have heard from the president repeatedly, your response is that we can't afford it? Is it as simple as that, or that it's not a formula that would work even if we could somehow?
It's not a formula that would work even if we could, even if we were to pour in, let's say, 400,000 troops, because fundamentally a country like Afghanistan is only going to be rebuilt by its own citizens. There are certain kinds of things that we, the United States, its allies, can do to help, but it's really in a supportive role. If you look at the success in Iraq of the surge, the key to that was the Iraqi political system. The Shia parties, the president, the Sunni tribes coming on board and creating some kind of functioning stability. The problem in Afghanistan is we simply don't have those ingredients. The Afghan government doesn't have that kind of mass political base. We don't have the tribal groups coming to us actively. So that, unfortunately, what we're going to find is that the international community can put a lot of energy in, but ultimately it's going into someone else's country, which is like going into somebody else's family. There's only so much you can do, and really what you can do is provide advice and technical assistance. Ultimately, you have to let go of that boulder. And I'm afraid in Afghanistan, the government, the economy, the society is just not ready there to take the weight. So the kind of structures we're creating are not sustainable.
But go at the argument, and you do a kind of dissection of it in your London Review of Books piece, because we're presented with a rationale for going in that's very hard to resist. You know, dangerous territory, home to al-Qaeda, can't go back to chaos. If it does, we're all in mortal danger. Must go in, fix it all. Dismantle that. Give us your path.
I'm afraid what happens is that we have a tendency, and maybe this is something to do with modern politics or the modern media, always to imagine the very worst case scenario. So when we look at somewhere like Afghanistan, instead of saying this is a poor, fragile, traumatized country, like many others in the world, we tend to paint it in the very, very most exaggerated light. We tend to say, if we falter for a moment, the Taliban will take over the country again, they'll invite in Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda will be massively strengthened, they'll attack us again. In other words, we imagine the very worst. And we're equally maximalist in our response. We don't seem to be able to say, okay, we're going to put some resources into this, we're going to do five or six things. Instead, we think, this is the great big existential challenge. We need to swamp it with troops. We need to try to fix almost every element of the Afghan state and society. I think, unfortunately, the world is obviously an incredibly complicated place. It's problematic, I think, particularly for the United States, which is a country which has done so much good in the world. And, of course, my experience as somebody who's teaching in the States, I find that Americans are very can-do people. They're very reluctant to say that a mission is impossible. Unfortunately, I think in Afghanistan, we may have reached a limit case. We may have reached a country which is, sadly, so poor, so fragile, so traumatized, that even the ambition of creating an effective, prosperous, functioning state may prove to be beyond us. That's something Afghans themselves can do over decades. But I don't think it's something that the United States could do, however many resources it put in.
But you're not saying walk away. There's a lot of talk about cranking up, and we are cranking up troop levels, all together with the NATO troops, maybe 90,000 now. You're saying stay, but cut it down to 20,000 and do what? We're told repeatedly in the United States that, you know, at the current level, there are not enough. We need more. You're saying take it down to 20,000 and do what?
I'm saying that our main priority there is to try to prevent Al-Qaeda from mounting attacks against the United States or Europe. That's really what we came in there for. That's really what, from a national security point of view, our priority should be. So this 20,000 figure is plucked out of the air. I don't stand particularly by that figure. What I do stand by is the idea that we need a much lighter footprint, and it would be a footprint that would be targeted on containing and managing any threat, preventing terrorist training camps from being reestablished, looking at it in very narrow counter-terrorist terms. And the second thing we should be doing because we have a moral responsibility, I believe, to do this, is to try to help the Afghan people through development, through investment in education and health and infrastructure. What we mustn't believe is that none of these things are possible without creating a state. That's the danger. What people will come back and say is, well, you can't do any development without security. Or they'll say, you can't stop Al-Qaeda from reestablishing itself unless you try to garrison the whole country. I don't believe that. I believe there is an option for us to have a lighter footprint. I think we need to find it because we have many other priorities in the world. And I think we'll find the situation is not as bad as we pretend.
Rory Stewart walked across Afghanistan. He's a diplomat, soldier, scholar, joining us today from London. Mr. Stewart, let me bring some callers in here, if I may. From Shrewsbury, Massachusetts, Sean, you're on the air with Rory Stewart.
Hello. Hi, Rory. I appreciate you taking my call. I guess I have a few questions I'd like to pose, and I have to say, on face value, I disagree with your assertions. You know, Afghanistan was a country that was after the Soviet invasion that was basically in disarray. We left it alone, left it to its own devices, and what happened was there was a government that took over that allowed Al-Qaeda in that did attack us. And I think to make any type of comparison between Iraq and Afghanistan is incorrect. There was a war of choice and a war of necessity. Afghanistan did attack us. And part of the reason it did attack us is because after the Soviets left, we ignored it and allowed that to fester and foster a situation where that happened. If we do the same, you can't say that can't happen again. It's very likely that it could. And I guess I would pose the question to you, do you think that Britain, after World War One, should have done more to prevent Germany, coming back into World War Two? It's a similar situation. It might be different, but it is very similar in the analogy. Would the United States have let Japan, just walked away from Japan after we won them in World War Two?
Sean, let us pick it up right there. You've got a lot on the table. Yeah. Rory Stewart.
Yeah, I can completely see where you're coming from, and these kinds of views are very important because this is what underlies a lot of the administration's policy. Basically, we need to be very careful, though, about analogies. Afghanistan is nothing like Germany or Japan. Germany and Japan were highly sophisticated industrialized countries with highly educated populations, and the success of the U.S. Marshall Plan, which was very successful, was based on the strengths that pre-existed in those countries and within those populations, which don't exist in Afghanistan. Afghanistan in 1991, after the Soviet withdrawal, was a very, very different place to Afghanistan in 2009. 18 years have passed. The Taliban has been discredited. They've been in government. People didn't like them in government. It's also a situation in which groups in the central and the north of the country are much stronger than they were in 1991. There isn't a civil war taking place. If the Taliban were to come back, I would say the likelihood is that they would be able to establish some kind of presence in rural areas in the south and the east. But they don't have the capacity to take a city. They don't have artillery. They don't have tanks. This time they don't have the support of the Pakistan army.
They sure did it briskly last time, if I may interject. I mean, they took Kabul, it seemed, in overnight, practically.
That's absolutely right. They were invited into area after area across the country by the Afghans themselves, because they were seen then, in 94-95, as this very pure group of young students who were going to eliminate corruption. But of course, Afghans learned their lessons from that. And furthermore, their takeover was really financed and supported by the Pakistan army. So it's extremely unlikely they could repeat that. It's also unlikely that if they were to repeat that, they would bring back al-Qaeda. And finally, it's extremely implausible, even were they to bring back al-Qaeda, that they could provide real support for them. They're not actually in a position to provide a safe haven against our special forces or our technology. This is a very, very poor country. This is why bin Laden is in Pakistan.
But we had special forces and technology. I'm sorry, Rory, but we had special forces and technology before. We used to send cruise missiles into Afghanistan once in a while. It didn't stop 9/11.
No, it didn't stop 9/11, and I think we've learned the lesson from that. Certainly what we did in the 1990s was not sufficient, and we'd certainly need much more focus and much more presence than we had then. But the problem that we're getting here is people have got a very either-or view. They seem to imagine that either we need to garrison the whole country with hundreds of thousands of troops, or we depart and we leave it alone. What I'm saying is that there's a more intelligent, lighter option. We don't want to repeat the errors of the 1990s where we did nothing, but we need to acknowledge that actually at the moment, and since 2001, we have made Afghanistan a place where al-Qaeda does not operate. Osama bin Laden is not based there. Instead, he is in Pakistan, and he's in Pakistan because, in fact, the kind of state sovereignty, by which I mean Pakistan's ability to prevent us operating there, provides more protection for him than he would have in Afghanistan, even, I suggest, under the Taliban.
Let's get another call from Ferndale, Michigan. Norman, you're on the air with Rory Stewart.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I was impressed by the guy's knowledge of the region, but my problem with the whole problem in Afghanistan and Iraq is that they're essentially artificial states created by European imperialism before the first war, and they were created on a map regardless of tribal affiliation and regions. Kazakhstan was eliminated as a nation, and Tajikistan was split up. I mean, in Afghanistan, you have four or five different ethnic populations that have no relationship to a central government. And same is true in Iraq. Iraq is an artificial state created by Britain. And
what do you take from that, Norman?
Well, with no regard for tribal loyalty and identification, I think that the best solution for the Middle East is that we reverse the imperialism of pre-war Russia and Germany and France.
And the United Kingdom, perhaps?
Yeah. Well, yeah, Britain was the biggest player of the three.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is if we created more of a federalist system with greater power to provincial regional states and paid more attention to the people living there.
Norman, let us pick it up right there. It's an interesting point, especially for our British guest. Rory Stewart, what do you say?
Well, he's broadly speaking right. I mean, I'd have a few disagreements. Afghanistan, of course, has existed as a state much longer than a country like Iraq. But certainly it's true that the border with Pakistan is an artificial creation. It's certainly true that there are many different tribal groups. And most importantly of all, I would agree with him that we need to look at a much more devolved, less centralized governmental system. The strength of Afghanistan really lies in its village communities. When I walked across the country, I walked across the country at a time when there was no government. And I was able to do it safely because community after community took me in, looked after me, took responsibility for their own areas. So those are the kinds of strengths, that local self-reliance, those shared ethical values that exist in Afghanistan from which a state should be built. But the important thing is to understand that the people to build that state, the founding fathers required, have to be Afghans. they can't be foreigners. I mean, however much we believe that we understand the history or the culture of somebody else's society, we simply are never going to have the knowledge or the legitimacy to go in there and micromanage their constitutions. It requires Afghan leadership to appeal to Afghan national imagination. And that's why we have to push back against the garrison approach, push back against this idea that somehow we can create a state or that we can accelerate this process. I'd much rather see an honest assessment of what our minimum national security priorities are there, and an honest assessment of what we might be able to provide in humanitarian terms to Afghans, and get out of the game of trying to create a state and exaggerating our own power.
That is quite a departure from the Obama administration. You're noted as an outside advisor to the U.S. envoy to the region, Richard Holbrooke. He's in the region right now. He'll be in Afghanistan for the elections. He was just in Pakistan, where some Pakistanis were saying, get out of Afghanistan, please. And he said, no way. The U.S. will not support a withdrawal from Afghanistan until the country was no longer at risk of descending into turmoil.
So Ambassador Holbrooke is an incredibly impressive man, and I'm in no way an official advisor to him. Mm-hmm. He's been kind enough to listen to me and talk to me, which I appreciate. But of course, yes, my views are quite different from those of the administration. And I'm concerned that, in fact, in the United States and even in Europe, there isn't a clear enough sense of what we can't do. I think probably some people in the administration may, if I was honest, sense that we're not making as much progress as we imagined, and we probably are not going to achieve the things we're talking about, but that for very domestic political reasons, they're not prepared to admit it. It may be, for example, that there are people even in President Obama's administration who are sounding tough on Afghanistan because they want to defend their national security reputation, having supported the withdrawal from Iraq. That doesn't necessarily mean that in their heart of hearts or in the long watches of the night, they really believe they're going to be able to transform what is a very, very tricky, poor country. I mean, there's no precedent in the world, I think, for turning a country like this around in the way that we're suggesting we could.
Let's get a quick call from Berkshire, Vermont, and Krista. Krista, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. I just wanted to say that I feel that President Obama right now, for quite a while now, he has been absolutely air-serving about Iraq and Afghanistan. He promised us that he would get our men out of Iraq, that he would put a stop to the war, but all he has done is shift the men from Iraq to Afghanistan, and it just continues, and he has absolutely no sense how he is going to solve it. And I believe your guest is 100% right about the failure of this whole thing.
Do you think President Obama needs to stay in Afghanistan to maintain his political reputation, his standing as, you know, commander-in-chief, tough on national security, Krista?
Yes, I know he does, but he has promised to get us out, and he needs to get us out. No country has ever won a war in Afghanistan. We're fighting a whole different mentality over there than we fought in the Second World War or the First World War. We are fighting a different attitude. We're fighting a force that is so rooted in history that anybody who has ever read history, and I have a great deal, it is unwinnable because we cannot get the people to think our way.
Krista, thanks very much for your call. Roy Stewart, we just got 30 seconds before the break, but Krista's kind of singing your song. You say maybe there's some speculation along these lines somewhere in the White House now? I mean, have you heard people in the U.S. government, you know, wondering over beers if, well, maybe have we got this wrong? Do we get stuck into a campaign promise here?
Well, my sense is that this is not really a question that people can really debate. I mean, my sense is they've made their commitment. This is what they're going to do, and they're not very interested in people telling them it's impossible.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On the eve of Afghan elections, we're getting a reality check this hour on the war and America's goals in Afghanistan. Talking with British diplomat, soldier, scholar Rory Stewart. He walked across Afghanistan in 2002, wrote about it in his book, The Places in Between, was a deputy governor in the coalition administration in southern Iraq in 2003. He's now professor and director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Also founder of the Turquoise Mountain Foundation with some financing, I think, from Prince Charles, dedicated to restoring Kabul and supporting Native Crafts talk about building a base right down at the bottom. He joins us today from London. Rory, we have a lot of questions from listeners here. Let's get one from West Hartford, Connecticut, and Natalie. Natalie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Quick question. I hear the speaker, the guest, saying a couple of things, and I just want to clarify, because this is what I have a question on.
Mm-hmm.
He says to lighten our footprint, 20,000, so that we can educate the people and also keep Al-Qaeda from bombing the United States. And also, just sounds like lessen our intention there so that the people there have a clear distinction of what they're doing. But in a way, isn't that what we're doing now? And with 20,000 people on the ground, is that really practical? I mean, will these people stay safe by what it looks now? By all accounts, they're getting bombed quite a bit. And the other question I have to him is, you know, what if we got out of there completely? What would this look like in his opinion? And thirdly, you know, what do we do as a people here in the United States? We're all kind of confused about this war, and, you know, we've been watching it, but is it time for us to say, like, let's get out of here completely? And I'm open to his answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Natalie. Rory, bring it down to brass tacks for us, if you would, then. I mean, Natalie's ears are open, but you want exactly what's the difference between what's going on now, she asks, and what you're proposing. Get very, very practical, if you would, very detailed.
Yeah. Well, what we're doing at the moment is a strategy which has been taken from Iraq, which is called Clear, Hold, Build. And basically that strategy is a strategy of garrisoning the country. Troops go in, and that's why we've got nearly 100,000 troops now going into Afghanistan, and the commanders are asking for 30,000 more.
That's,
and they're talking
60,000 some U.S. plus NATO troops up to nearly 100, you said.
And they're asking for another 30,000, mm-hmm. and they're also talking about creating an Afghan army and police force of nearly 400,000 people. The reason for this is, their strategy is to try to clear the Taliban out of the area. Then they hold it. In other words, they garrison these areas to prevent them coming back in. And then they try to build up the economy and politics and society. So it's a very, very labor-intensive process in a huge country, mm-hmm. country the size of Texas, mm-hmm. with a population of 30 million people. What's the difference between that and what I'm proposing? Well, I wouldn't be proposing that. I don't think we are able to clear, hold, or build. We can't build because the Afghan government doesn't have the kind of capacity to create the kind of political growth or economic growth in these areas. We don't have enough troops to garrison the whole of Afghanistan from one end to the other. We wouldn't have the political will, commitment to hold it even if we did. But most importantly of all, I think, it's to understand that we're creating a very dangerous codependent relationship here. We're basically writing a blank check to the Afghans. And I had an Afghan politician say to me recently, please stop saying that Afghanistan is a poor country. You have to say Afghanistan is the number one terrorist threat in the world. That way we can continue to get tens of billions of dollars worth of investment every year. We can continue to skim money off all these kinds of operations. If you ever start suggesting that Afghanistan is not the number one terrorist threat in the world, then we might start losing out. Now, that's very dangerous. We need to detach. We need to recognize that Afghanistan is a problematic country, but it's one amongst many. And to push on to the answer to the listener's question, no, we shouldn't withdraw. I think withdrawal at this stage would be extremely destructive for our reputation. It would betray many people in Afghanistan who believe in us, and it would create further instability in the region. What I think we should be thinking about is the next 30, 40 years. If I'm right that Afghanistan isn't going to be able to be transformed except over decades, we need to acknowledge what we can't do, i.e. we can't build a state. Afghans may be able to, but the United States and Europe can't build a state there. What we can do is try to leave enough troops in place to contain and manage the terrorist threat and to try to ensure we provide some development assistance. So that's quite different to the big garrisoning vision.
Contain and manage the terrorist threat. I wish you'd flesh that out a little bit. You say maybe 20,000 troops, something like that, as opposed to 100,000. You said earlier special forces and technology. I assume you mean that means commandos and what, targeted bombing? Or what's the military sort of face that you would have facing Afghanistan?
I wouldn't want to push this through. Essentially, I'd want to say to the military, listen, realistically, we're not going to be able to keep hundreds of thousands of troops in this country for the next 40 years. And I'd say to the military planners, tell us what we can do with less. I imagine what they would say is we could do what we were doing in 2002, 2003, 2004. During that period, we made the country too uncomfortable for Al-Qaeda to operate, but we didn't control the rural areas of the country. We weren't able to eliminate corruption. We weren't able to operate judicial systems. A lot of the country was not properly governed, so we'd probably return to a situation that resembled that. How would we do it? Well, we just have to focus on what we're really worried about. What are we really worried about? We're worried about in very brutal terms, a bomb going off in the United States or in Europe. We need to think about how those attacks are planned, what kinds of people are planning them. 95% of the people we're fighting in Afghanistan have no intention of attacking the United States or Europe. They're mostly rural, semi-literate villagers from the Afghan-Pakistan borders who are fighting for a variety of reasons, for pay, for revenge, because they don't like foreign troops, but they probably couldn't find the United States on a map. In terms of the real al-Qaeda threat, we're looking at a much smaller number of very sophisticated people, most of whom are not Afghans, and we need to think about the various ways in which we can disrupt their operations and stop them having the planning capacity which would massively increase their ability to harm us.
But more questions militarily, but politically. Presumably, I mean, there's a nightmare vision that anybody sitting in the White House, for that matter, anybody in Whitehall doesn't want to see that. You know, we withdraw, and the next thing you know, you've got, I don't know, Osama bin Laden and Mullah Omar sitting in Kabul and Hamid Karzai's head on a pike, and they're thumbing their nose at the U.S., and you know, it's a political catastrophe in a post-9/11 world. Is that out there as a danger? Kabul's overrun? I mean, you said unlikely, but American planners can hardly, presumably, think of taking a risk of some kind of...
Unfortunately, and I think even American planners would say this, planners need to take some risk. You cannot, in a world this size, when you're dealing with the instability in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, in North Korea, in Iran, where we're even presumably worrying about Saudi Arabia and Egypt, you can't imagine that you can micromanage every country in the world or have no risk. What you ask a planner to do strategically is to try to look at the realistic threats and allocate resources accordingly. What's happened in this case in Afghanistan is we've gone completely over the top. We've tried to go for a zero-risk environment, which is pushing us to deploy more and more and more troops. And at the same time, we're taking our eye off the ball of much more important countries like Pakistan.
We read about whole swaths of Afghanistan under Taliban control. Why wouldn't that Taliban-colored portion of the map just expand endlessly if the U.S. had a smaller footprint? Maybe not al-Qaeda, but Taliban at least. And then, you know, the fear is ultimately if Taliban's in control, that's a petri dish for al-Qaeda.
I'd like just for us to think that through a little bit. I think it's perfectly realistic that the Taliban control over South and Eastern Afghanistan would increase if we were to withdraw our troops. How much it would increase, how long, I don't know. But what does it exactly mean to say they would provide a petri dish for al-Qaeda? At the moment, al-Qaeda is based on the Pakistan frontier. They're really based there because our special forces operatives can't operate freely in Pakistan. Afghanistan, ironically, because it's a failed state, is a place where we can operate quite freely. So what would bin Laden gain by crossing the border from where he is in Pakistan to Afghanistan? What kind of protection could the Taliban really give him? They are an extremely technologically primitive movement. They don't have any real capacity to provide any technological support for them. I guess, and maybe I'm exaggerating this, but I guess the most they could do is say, come in, you can pitch your tent over there. In other words, they could give him a field to put himself. How much really does that help al-Qaeda compared to where they are now? How does that make us more at risk in the United States and Europe? Why would we not then be able to fly in Delta Force or take that out? Why would we not be able to hit it with a Predator drone? So what I really want people to spell out is what exactly the connection is. And maybe there is more of a connection than I can see.
But the American narrative...
been explained to me.
I'm sorry, Roy, but the American narrative post-9/11 was, gee whiz, here was this primitive country of rocks, and it produced a threat that took down, you know, skyscrapers in our major city. So our history tells us that it may just be, you know, a poor country in the middle of nowhere, but it hit us before and hit us hard. Is that no longer an active risk threat dynamic?
Well, essentially what happened, as you remember, before 2001, is that the Taliban, which was an extremely impoverished government, which basically ran its finance ministry out of a box under a bed in Kabul, allowed Osama bin Laden to operate training camps in the country. And the people who did those attacks, of course, were not Afghans. Bin Laden's a Saudi billionaire. Zawahiri is a very high-class Egyptian doctor. Mohammed Atta was a German resident with a master's degree. So these quite sophisticated international people passed through training camps in Afghanistan, did some planning in Hamburg, learned to fly planes in Florida, and pulled off this horrendous attack. But what we really need to look at in that is what kind of safe haven was the Taliban really providing? If Clinton had wanted to, could he have taken more aggressive action earlier on to deal with it? And what kind of protection could the Taliban provide for them in the future? So instead of getting caught up in the question, yes, then 9/11 had happened, these people passed through Afghanistan, and getting into our head, therefore, if Afghanistan was under Taliban control, it would happen again. Let's look more widely at the world. Let's ask, what are the threats from Yemen? What are the threats from Somalia? What are the threats from Pakistan? I guess if I was the president, I'd be worried that the next attack would come from Pakistan. And then I'd be worried that people like me would say, what on earth did you think you were doing, putting all this energy into Afghanistan, when we know perfectly well that the majority of the serious al-Qaeda operatives are based and are planning from Pakistan, not from Afghanistan.
President Obama says it's all one war.
We're in the wrong country.
We're told it's all one war, Afghan, Pakistan. It's all one threat, one problem.
Well, the way I'd illustrate that is to say that it's like you're going into a room with an angry cat and a big tiger. And the angry cat is Afghanistan and the big tiger is Pakistan. Pakistan has nuclear bombs. Pakistan has Bin Laden. Pakistan can destabilize India. And you're in that room and you're whacking the cat. And somebody says to you, why are you whacking the cat? And you say, oh, it's a cat-tiger strategy. It's an Afghanistan-Pakistan strategy. Really, the reason we're whacking the cat is we don't know what to do about the tiger.
Let's go to Tom in Toledo, Ohio. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I applaud you for bringing this exceptional guest. I wish we have hear more voices like that on the radio and the TV. I absolutely agree with the guest. I have some Afghan friends who are here in the United States, and they're telling me that, you know, the sentiment now toward Americans are much worse than it was 8 years ago. We've been doing the same thing for 8 years. What did you achieve? Nothing. We're draining our treasures. The Chinese are sitting, you know, laughing at us. We have to put our pride on the side. Barack Obama is doing the same thing that George Bush did. He didn't want to acknowledge that he fell in Iraq, and he's doing the same exact thing. You know, we need to get out, and then, like this, what the speaker suggested, see what we can do. We can manage the threat. We can embolden and strengthen the moderate faction of Taliban. Taliban is a fact of life. They're not going to go. Not all the Taliban are Al-Qaeda. You know, we can talk to the moderate ones. We can strengthen them and, you know, let them take care of their country. We need to learn from history. History taught us that nobody can control anybody. On a personal level, on a state level, you know, it's been in Vietnam, in Korea, and Iraq.
Tom, we've got it, and our time dwindles down, but I appreciate your call from Toledo very much. And let me get one more while we have time from Columbia, South Carolina, and Lukeman. Lukeman, you're on the air with Rory Stewart.
Thank you for taking my call. My own opinion is this, and this is what nobody is talking about.
Oh, I'm sorry, Lukeman. The line is just breaking up too much there, and I'm sorry for that. Let me get one more here from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Lee. Lee, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm very thankful for this excellent program and an opportunity to respond. I have to pretty much totally agree with your guest, Mr. Stewart's opinions. But I actually would go a step further. I think that most, if not all, of our troops and everyone else's troops ought to be out of everywhere, including Afghanistan, and take all the money that I see we're just dumping down numerous black holes, which in turn lead to other black holes, and strengthen our borders, strengthen our national security, and provide somehow some kind of support for people like Greg Mortensen, who managed to fly under the radar and build schools.
Three cups of tea, Greg Mortensen, yeah.
You know, support efforts like that to do what we can do to stabilize the country, but not try and squash every little threat that we see popping up. I think we ought to pay a little more attention to our own national security.
Lee, our time is short, but thank you very much. Roy Stewart, how about this? You're invested through the Turquoise Foundation in small-scale kind of nation-building, I guess, if I may say small-scale. But is nation-building still part of the formula you see? Lighter military footprint, but still, I don't know, nation-building, development? How do you describe it, and what would it look like?
I don't believe it's nation-building. What we do with Turquoise Mountain, and we do this, in fact, with some very generous support from the United States, both from the government and from private people, is we're working in the center of the old city of Kabul. We've got an elementary school. We've got a clinic. We do sewage, water supply, we're restoring buildings, and we have a traditional craft school where women and men make woodwork, jewelry, calligraphy. They export these crafts, and we bring the money back into the old city. this isn't a nation-building project. This is really a development project. It's working with a very poor community. It's trying to restore a positive sense of Afghan identity and pride. I think there are many things like that that could be done around the country. There were great successes in the early years, particularly in education and health. And I think if we... I mean, this is the message. Although we can do less than we pretend, we can do in Afghanistan much more than we fear. There are many positive stories there. And if we can just step away from this idea that this is the be-all and end-all, that this is the most terrifying terrorist threat in the world, that there's no limit to how many troops or money we can put in, we might be pleasantly surprised to find that actually there are many useful things that wealthy, technologically sophisticated countries with very dedicated staff like the United States can do for poor countries like Afghanistan. And these things can be done both for humanitarian reasons and also in terms of our national security. So I just want to try to get these politicians out of this black and white mindset where they think, you know, either we swarm in the troops or we get out the door, and instead try to think of a more nuanced, realistic policy that can help us and help them.
A little perspective on the eve of Afghanistan's elections. I should say you can read Rory Stewart's piece, The Irresistible Illusion, from the London Review of Books at our website, onpointradio.org. Rory Stewart joins us today from London. Thank you very much. I hope we talk with you again. Thanks a lot for your perspective today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.